Welcome everybody at the sociology seminar. Wings, somewhere I forgot exactly where this week, so he asked me to chair. Well, our speaker today doesn't need a lot of introduction, I think, so I will just say the floor is yours, Colin, and stop you in about an hour's time.
Okay, thank you very much, Christian. Right, well, thank you very much for inviting me, as they say. I've come all the way from round the corner there, unlike most of the speakers this term. I'm going to talk about a piece of work that is joint work with Ursula Hens from London School of Economics, and this is something which is loosely based, more loosely perhaps than is entirely desirable, on a paper that we are currently touting and have been touting for a little while around the journals, not, I must say, with an enormous amount of success at the moment, but hope springs eternal. Maybe you can give me some clues as to why our referees don't like us so much. Right. The title is Social Mobility, Marriage and Societal Openness in Great Britain, and you will see that there is one small change from the advertised title. Those of you who are sharp-eyed will see that I changed 2006 to 2005 actually to make it consistent with something that's in one of the tables. The difficulty, of course, is one of the surveys that we make use of in this paper actually straddles 2005, 2006, and in my increasingly decrepit old age, I can never remember which year to refer to. So sometimes I refer to it as a 2006 survey, sometimes to a 2005 survey. If I do so in my dotage, I'm really referring to the same piece of evidence. Right, well, without more ado, let's get on to the meat of the paper. And I want to start off in rather literary form with some quotations from the Times Literary Supplement, a rather unusual start to a topic in this department, no doubt. My guess is there are not so many readers of the TLS sitting here. And this is a rather ancient pair of comments from a review of John Goldthorpe's Social Mobility and Class Structure in Modern Britain, first published in 1980, revised in 1987. This is a review of the first edition by Gary Runciman, who some of you may have heard of. And in the course of what I think is rather long and in places slightly peevish review of this book, Runciman makes the following observations. The implications of the findings for the questions about class formation and social structure cannot be elucidated without relating them to the very topics that this volume does not attempt to deal with, such as patterns of marriage. A classic reviewer's comment criticise something for what it doesn't do rather than say something about what it does do. In other words, I wish you had written the book that I would have written. Unfortunately, you've written another book, but I'm going to tell you about the book that I would prefer you to have written. And then at the bottom, but mobility ratios are only one of the sources on which a diagnosis of the changing class structure of 20th century Britain must rest, to which we give hearty assent. Basically, actually, Runciman was fairly spot on. I don't think that you can actually claim to give a comprehensive account of the pattern of social stratification without reference to marriage. And indeed, mobility, defined in the classic way from father to son or from parents to child's generation, is but one way of looking at this sort of issue or generating evidence which is relevant to saying something about the issue. So in this paper we're going to take Gary Runciman's points up, and we're going to look at something a little bit different from the classic intergenerational social mobility tables, though we're not going to stray very far from the Nuffield orthodoxy. As you'll see, what it all boils down to in the end is a lot of square table analysis. We never consider more than three variables at a time. Three is quite enough, actually. Any more is really an indulgence. Right. So now I do a little bit of defensive posturing. I'm going to give forewarning and say something about the sorts of people who will not like this paper, of which there are indeed probably very many. You will not like this paper if you have come here to see something which is about social mechanisms, which is about causality, or which has a big narrative structure about the underlying reasons behind the changes that we want to investigate. Why will you not like it? Because basically we don't say anything very much about these things. This is essentially an exercise in rather simple-minded description, for which I am completely unapologetic. What we are particularly interested in is looking at assortative mating basically as an index of macro-level social openness. We're not interested in micro-level mechanisms. In fact, the data that we have don't allow us to say anything meaningful about micro-level mechanisms, and you'll just have to accept that. I could try and spin you a story, I suppose, but it's not very sensible to do so. Basically, we're interested in treating assortative mating as a kind of index that will tell us something at the macro level about openness. So the second piece of expectation structuring is then to say, okay, what are you actually going to do? Well, what we're going to actually look at is assortative mating by parental social class background, basically. So we have some data, quite a lot of data actually, which has some more or less, and we'll come back to this in a moment, more or less comparable measures of the social class backgrounds in the sense of the jobs or occupations that the fathers of the people who got married had. And we're going to look at the association between the father's social class of the husband and the father's social class of the wife. Now, there's a little bit of this kind of thing around. If you go back to one of the first sort of systematic empirical inquiries on social mobility, David Glass's 1954 book, you'll see that that quite a lot of that book is actually about not about social mobility in the sort of father-to-son sense. And there is actually an extremely interesting chapter in that book by Jerzy Berendt about exactly assortative mating in our sense, in the sense of looking at parental social origins of marriage partners. However, since then, if you look in the literature, you'll see that papers that have looked at assortative mating or marital homogamy, those that have looked at parental social class background are rather few and far between. There are a few, but not very many, and they are completely swamped by the large number of papers, so many that I can't claim to have read them all. It's really a little industry which looks at assortative mating in terms of the educational levels attained by marital partners. There are vast numbers of these papers for just about all conceivable societies which have any data. And so the question arises, why don't we just join the bandwagon? And apart from the obvious, it's nice to do something something different. I think there are reasons for believing that education might not always be a sensible thing to look at. Now, having said that, I'm going to immediately draw back from that rather extreme statement and introduce a caveat, which is that I suppose, rather self-contradictory, we are actually writing something now which looks at both parental background and partners' education as well. So, at the risk of contradicting myself, the reason why I don't think education is necessarily the thing that one should be looking at is that there is a sense in which education is endogenous to the underlying process. Okay, people choose their education and they choose their marriage partners, if not simultaneously, at least not necessarily in a rather fixed kind of order. And this matters when one's looking at long-term trends. It's not completely fanciful to believe that in the perhaps not so distant past, one of the things that women might have done is to think about the level of education that they would aim at and their likely marriage prospects at the same time. And if they had already found a potential partner, for example, or anticipated that they would soon find a potential partner, and, again thinking about the past, that they believed that their future was not necessary in the labour market, they may well decide to terminate their educational career at a relatively early point in time. Now, of course, if you're looking at trends over time and we compare people in terms of their educational status, this would of course generate a certain amount of asymmetry, which is often commonly observed. There is a tendency towards hypergamy in the sense that better educated men have a tendency to choose less well educated women. But of course this may well be partly in a sense artifactual. It's not completely implausible to believe that if there was some kind of underlying variable, I don't know what that might be exactly, but sort of educatedness or ability or something like that. This will be indexed in quite different ways by the formal qualification system at different times, particularly if over time women are less likely to reason in that sort of way. As more and more women get education, fewer and fewer will be terminating their education prematurely. So what we might actually be getting if one was to look at that data would be slightly misleading in the sense that my guess is in the distant past smart women married smart men, probably. It just so happens that how that's indexed when you look at it in terms of formal qualifications doesn't completely map on to that distinction. Okay. So that's one of the reasons why we're not looking at education in this particular paper. Okay, and then finally, if you're not grabbed by any of these motivations for what we're doing, I'll offer you another one here, which is, of course, that assortative mating is a source of intergenerational change in inequality. So what do I mean by that? Well, what we mean by it is really encapsulated just in three little equations here. And this is an argument which is not at all original to us. You can certainly find it in a paper by David Coleman in a book published in the 1970s. And in fact, Rob Mayer has used the version of exactly the same argument in one of his papers on marital homogamy, and we just shamelessly stolen it from there, in fact. But the argument actually has its origins in biology. As is well known, for example, Coleman points this out, assortative mating with respect to genetically heritable traits increases the variability of that trait in the next generation. So if we take over this sort of biological model and make an analogy, analogical reasoning can be applied to social characteristics that are inherited from both parents. Okay, so what's the argument here? Well, consider a model of the following form, in which F, M, and Y are the social characteristics of the father, the mother, and the child, respectively. For instance, their educational level, or their occupational level, or anything that can be measured continuously. And this has to be, in some sense, something which can be passed on with big scary marks around it to the child. And then we also have in the model, obviously, some random error as well. And we express F and M and Y and epsilon all as deviations from their mean. So we end up with something like this expression here for child I. Now, of course, in this context, what's passed on or inherited is definitely not meant to be taken literally. This is a metaphor in some sense, but it indicates attributes captured by F and M, or resources that are connected with these attributes that have some sort of causal effect on Y. such that F and M is predictive of Y. Okay, so it's a rather milder statement than saying that things are really, strictly speaking, inherited. After all, very few people in our society inherit their father's occupation, for example, literally. Okay, so if then we look at the level of the means, the mean of Y has a very simple relationship to the means of F and M. This is very straightforward. You find this in, of course, all statistics textbooks describing linear regression, for example. Now, if we make a simplifying assumption... Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's exactly the case. That's why there's no intercept in it. Yeah? Is that problematic in some way?
No, it's why would you write it down?
Why not?
To say zero.
Why not? Okay, so, and of course this is in some sense irrelevant to the main point here, which is captured down here, which is we want to say something about the variation in the next generation. Okay, so the variance here of Y is a function of course, the slope coefficients and the variances of F and M, but also, of course, of the covariances, or the covariance between F and M, which is just a fancy way of saying that the variance of Y partly depends on the covariance between the father's and the mother's attributes. So the bigger this is here, as long as this is positive here, then the larger the variation is going to be in the next generation. So it's a very straightforward argument. From this it's immediately obvious that the variance of Y is a function of the covariance of F and M. And thus, if like tend to marry like, or at least breed with like, then the inequality in the child's generation is going to increase. It's a completely standard sort of argument. Okay. Of course, there are a lot of ceteris paribus assumptions here, which I'm just going to skate over. And this actually turns out in practice to be quite important. So this is a theoretical reason why we might be interested in the extent to which like marry like. However, in practice, a lot of things may intervene in order to either make this relationship stronger or to completely net it out. And in fact, what little evidence we have seems to suggest that actually this is not a terribly important mechanism. For example, Richard Breen and Lara Salazar have quite a nice paper looking at earnings inequality within households as a function of whether men and women with similar educational levels tend to marry each other, and whether or not that's a plausible mechanism for explaining what has happened in just about all sort of certainly Anglo-related economies, which is over the past 10, 15 years or so, earnings inequalities have got much wider between households. And their conclusion is that no, it isn't, because actually there are lots of other things that are going on as well, which are either more important or which actually completely counterbalance this sort of effect. So this is a very theoretical argument, and how it actually works out in practice is really a matter, of course, of the empirics. Right, so what are we going to do? We are going to take some social survey data from Great Britain, and we're going to simply look at the current stock of marital unions in which both partners are 25 to 59 years of age. And this is really why I made my observation at the beginning that we don't say very much about mechanisms or causality and so on and so forth. Data on stocks are very, very ill-suited to making those kinds of analysis. Why are we doing this then? Well, basically because these are more or less the only data that exist in order to look at long-term trends over time. Where possible, we distinguish between England and Wales and Scotland, though, as it will turn out, this is actually rather inconsequential. How we treat the constituent parts of Great Britain doesn't actually matter very much, but we thought at the time it might be interesting to see whether there were any differences between England and Wales and Scotland. Okay, we've got data on a number of rather unevenly dispersed time points. And unfortunately, these are actually grouped in rather inconvenient ways. So we have data on 1949 and 1959 to 60, 72 to 76, 89 to 93, 2005, and within these time periods, and some of them, we have multiple measures. This is not ideal, but again, this is forced upon us because this is what basically exists. Couple more caveats. All of the things that I'm going to present you today, in all of the things I'll present today, we don't make any distinction at all between whether someone is formally legally married or whether they are cohabiting. Again, this is something which is forced upon us because in the early period, actually no real distinction is made. So the distinction doesn't exist in the data. It's simply assumed that men and women who were living together were legally married. For later time periods, we can actually make this distinction, and we have actually looked to see whether in the later time periods where we can look at the characteristics of legally married couples and those living in consensual unions separately, whether this makes any difference. And the rather surprising thing is, actually, it doesn't. We can find no evidence whatsoever of differences in the pattern or strength of association conditional on whether you're legally married or living in a consensual union. Which is surprising, I think. But it's not there in the data. Okay, so our basic unit of analysis then is a husband's father's occupation by wife's father's occupation cross-classification. So we've got a square table. Basically, on one side, we've got the husband's father's occupation. On the other side up here, or at the top, we've got the wife's father's occupation. We cross-classify them. And then we do that for each of the survey years. So we basically got a three-way array of data. Oh yeah, and one final thing, of course, the data refer to all current unions. This is also a problem again, or a difficulty, which is forced on us by what's collected in the data. So we don't know anything, actually, in most of these data sets about unions which have been contracted in the past but have finished before the date at which the current marriage is observed. And that's true of all but one of these data sets. Actually, our 1959 to 60 data actually refer to all first marriages, so there's a slight difference. You will see that in the course of what we did, we have to make all sorts of compromises. It is impossible to study this time period, 49 through to 76, in a completely consistent way, simply because data collection conventions changed during the time, and people made different coding decisions and different decisions about the way to collect data. And so occasionally we've had to make some compromises which some people will like and think are worthwhile and other people will hate, but you have to do something. I think that we've made a set of compromises which is in some sense defensible, but we'll see whether or not you agree. Okay, just to make all of that concrete, this is basically what we've got here. Time points down here, going from 1949 through to 2005. All sorts of different sources of data. Most of the data predominantly comes from the General Household Survey, but there are odd other surveys in there which happen to have information on father's or mother's father's social class for the husband or father's social class for the wife. So we've got the 72 Oxford Mobility Survey, the 74-75 Scottish Mobility Survey, 1991, which was the first year of the BHPS, British Household Panel Survey. We put that in there, partly to, as a kind of check to see what how it compares with data from the General Household Survey in the same year, right through to 2005 when we have the General Household Survey EU Silk supplement. So that's what we have for England and Wales. For Scotland, we've got actually no information really. That's not true. Okay. Most of the comparisons between England and Scotland are actually going to take place in this period here. We don't have any information after 92-93 for Scotland. There is some data in the 2005, but the sample size is too small to actually do anything sensible with it, at least at the level of disaggregation that we want to use. 59-60, the data actually relates to Great Britain. And we have no possibility of separating out England and Wales there. And there is a story behind this data, which at least one person sitting in this room knows about, because she actually spent some of her time inputting it for me. When we first started doing this work, we thought it would be very nice to have a time point somewhere between 1949 and 1972. This is a very long period of time. And we scrambled around and we discovered that in 1961, or actually before that, it was in 1959-60, in fact, the paper that describes it was published in 61. In 59-60, David Glass, or at least his Population Investigation Committee, carried out a survey called the Marriage Survey, which did in fact collect exactly the sort of information that we were interested in. Now, this data didn't exist in the Essex archive, and so with a bit of detective work, which basically involved contacting the Population Investigation Committee and then talking to Chris Langford there and so on, we managed to establish that the data had probably still existed right up until certainly the early 70s, but in the great changeover from mainframe computing to PC computing, the University of London Computing Centre had dumped all of his tapes in a skip somewhere, and he didn't actually have a copy of the data anymore. So at this point we thought, oh dear, we're not going to be able to do this. But then I noticed that David Coleman actually had been writing about this data again in the mid-70s, and it occurred to me that, you know, worth a try. Maybe he will have a copy of the data. So I talked to David Coleman over in social policy, and he told me more or less the same thing, that round about the time that Oxford switched over mainframe computing to PCs, his tapes had also been dumped in a skip somewhere, and he wouldn't have an electric copy of it anymore. However, he said he had a storeroom over in Barnet House, and perhaps there he had a vague memory that somewhere there in some dusty piles there were some old printouts of the complete data set that he had used, and he would go and look for them. So a few weeks later I went and sat in his office, and he brought out literally these dusty piles of old SPSS sort of output, and there was indeed a dump of something on there. And we spent a little bit of time trying to reconstruct exactly what these columns of numbers actually meant. And eventually we were able to convince ourselves as to what the content of some of it actually was. Now, we didn't have the complete data. What we had was a subset of data that David had used for his work. And clearly, a small part of the data is clearly missing. Possibly 1 or 2% of it, for some unexplained reason which he can't remember anymore, is not there. We're going to have to assume that data is missing at random, otherwise we can't do anything with it. So that's what we're going to do. And we have only a very limited number of variables, and perhaps more importantly, we just have it coded in the way that he coded it. And this is consequential for the occupational data. It places very big restrictions on what we can do with the occupational data. Okay, the more caveats I make, the more I realise why referees don't like our paper. Referees like nice, clear stories, not hedged around with lots of qualifications, not lots of ifs and buts, and not lots of reasons to disbelieve why the writer is telling you what they are telling you. The reason I'm mentioning it is this will become quite important when we actually interpret the data. Right, so we're getting down to actually the point where we actually think about what this data shows us. Starting point, the probability that someone from a given social class background will be found to have married someone with a similar background can be thought of as a function of two different things. The proportion of potential partners with that background, which in this case we're just going to interpret as the marginal distribution of social class or marginal distribution of occupation of the parents, and the propensity to choose similar rather than different partners. In other words, the association between class backgrounds. So you can see where we're going here, classic social mobility strategy. We're going to try and separate out the marginal effects from the association, basically. And moreover, and again, this is something that some people might not like very much, we're not going to be very interested in the overall probabilities, because that partly reflects simply the marginal distribution. We're going to take as our index of openness, basically the thing that's going to tell us about whether or not society has become more or less open over time, that's going to be really based on the association parameters from some log linear models. Okay. So our strategy then is simply to use some log linear models and some closely related models, which are not strictly speaking log linear models, but models that allow us to draw nice pictures, basically, to make a smooth descriptive representation of the main features of the pattern and level of association. So another reason not to like this paper, if you're a sort of person who doesn't believe in smooth representations, if you're someone who likes structural parameters, you will hate this. You will absolutely loathe it. We're taking this extremely descriptive, sort of somewhat statistical view that what we want to do is smooth the data so that we can just see what a nice picture it makes. Okay, and then try and draw some conclusions on the basis of that. I want to just mention two models. We actually consider a very wide range of different ways of smoothing the data in this paper. And then we eventually, again, for what we think are good reasons, hit on a couple of them simply so that we can draw a nice picture. But I'm not going to go through all of the possible ways in which we model the data. It would take far too long and be far too boring, actually. But in essence, the two most important models that we fit are, first of all, this one at the top up here, the log multiplicative layer effect model, sometimes known in these parts as the so-called UNIDIFF model, if you think about it, a peculiarly inappropriate name for it. But anyway, once a name's established, you can't really change it. So basically, the idea is that we look at a whole set of different tables, and we assume that there's a common baseline pattern of association there, and then we allow that baseline pattern of association to change in a particularly constrained way. And that is, we allow the log odds ratios in each of the table to change proportionately. Okay, so they all change in the same direction, as it were. They either get stronger or they get weaker, which is a very, very simplistic way of thinking about change. It's a very restrictive way, but it turns out quite often this is quite a useful way to capture an aspect of the process of change over time. And what we'll do eventually is then just plot those parameters with some confidence intervals, and that will allow us to make some kinds of statements about whether or not the association has been getting stronger or has been getting weaker over time. If in this case, this phi k parameter right up at the top here starts to get bigger than 1, it means that the association is basically getting stronger. If it starts to get less than 1, it means that all the odds ratios are shrinking, log odds ratios are shrinking towards 0, so association's getting weaker. If it's getting weaker, that we equate with more social openness. If it's getting stronger, that we equate with more social closure in some sense. Okay, so a lot of the donkey work is done with this sort of model here. There are various tricks and things that we look at. For example, you can do lots of different things with the basic association parameters. You can, for example, try to put some structure on those. So you might be interested in whether or not the pattern of exchanges between social classes is symmetrical or not. Each social class gives us roughly as many husbands as it gives wives back to the other side. That would be one thing you might look at. You might try to model hypergamy, in other words, the extent to which, in this particular case, it would tend to be the extent to which wives are more likely to come from lower social classes than husbands. As it turns out in our data, you will see that in the first time period, you won't see it because I'm not going to show it to you. I'm just going to tell you now. In the first time period, there is some very slight tendency towards hypergamy, but it's quantitatively so small that for all practical purposes you can ignore it. In the later time periods, there's no evidence of this whatsoever. Okay. Second sort of model we're going to use is this so-called Goodman RCM model. The deal here is that we actually don't really use this for any analytical purposes. We actually use this simply to draw a picture. Because, of course, it's one thing to say the association is getting stronger or weaker. That's one thing you might want to know. But you actually might want to know, well, what's the pattern? What's the baseline pattern of association here? What goes with what? Which social classes are closer to or further away from which other social classes? And again, there are lots of different ways in which you can do that, but we thought it would be most convenient simply as a presentational device to, after we found roughly what we want to find out with this sort of model here, to try and make a picture of the pattern of association. Okay? And we use this kind of model here. Basically, what this does is estimates both intrinsic association parameters, but also parameters for each of the different categories of the rows and columns of the table. And these are not constrained to be in any particular order. So it's a very flexible model, and we allow there to be several dimensions of association. It turns out to be the case that we get reasonable representations of the pattern of association by assuming two dimensions. But I'll show you some pictures of that a little bit later. Okay, one further qualification. We're stuck with the fact that we can't make direct comparisons between the early period, which is basically 1949, 1959-60, and 72, with the later period. Simply because the way in which the occupational data are recorded are incompatible with each other, basically. They just use different coding conventions. So what we've done is to basically analyse the first three surveys, so that's basically 49 through to 72, using the so-called Hall-Jones occupational categories. And we then take the 72 data, which can be, after a fashion, coded in two different ways. So that's a kind of hinge, if you like. 72 data is coded both to the Hall-Jones and to the so-called socioeconomic groups. So from 72 right through to 2005, we can code all the data consistently to socioeconomic, or somewhat consistently to socioeconomic groups. We have 11 different categories of these. And then, just to make things even more interesting, again, because actually the way in which occupational data are coded in government surveys again changed in 2001, we actually code two of the data sets to the new so-called NSX. That's the BHPS, the 1991 data, and the 2005 data, which are the only two which we can actually code in this way. To again check whether or not what we find at the end of the series is dependent on the way in which we code the data. But most of the analysis, basically, I'm going to show you relates to these two coding systems here. Okay, I think I'm going to skip all of this. There's a lot of details about the various models that we fitted, most of which are of no interest to most people. And let me just, maybe I'll just go back one. Let's just point out one thing here. Okay. What are we actually going to base our story on? We're actually going to base it on Model 5 here. Model 5 basically says there's a common pattern of association over the first three of our surveys, the 49, 59, 60, 72. So we're looking at the first three now in terms of the Hall-Jones scale, so a 5 by 5 table, three time points, so 5 by 5 by 3 array. We assume the pattern of association between husband's father's class and wife's father's class is the same in all of these tables, and then we allow the strength of that association to vary over the three tables. Okay? And what we actually find, in a nutshell, is that we cannot reject the hypothesis that the first two, in the first two tables, in other words, the contrast between 49 and 59, 60, we can't reject the hypothesis that the pattern of association is the same in those two tables. They're basically identical with each other. Okay? Bear in mind, of course, that the data are not quite the same. In the second of those tables, it's Great Britain rather than England and Wales. And it's also first marriages rather than all current marriages. So, you know, you pays your money. It's rather clear, however, that the 72 data are different. And the way in which the 72 data are different is that the pattern of association is clearly weaker. It's much weaker, in fact, in 72. Than it is in the first two tables. Okay, so now draw a picture. Why draw a picture? Simply because you want to know basically what the basic pattern is. So I just will here show you the plot for the 49 data. The difference, the only difference between the 59-60 data is that in the 59-60 data, actually, these points here are very fractionally to the left of all of these points. They're very fractionally closer to the origin. No, is that right? No, that's wrong. Sorry, it's the other way around. They're to the right of these points. So they're very fractionally to the right because association is actually very, very slightly stronger there. And for the 72 data, everything is much closer to the origin. So all the points maintain their relative position, but they're all scrunched up much closer to the origin, indicating basically that there's weaker association. Okay? If we actually look at the relative positions of the points here, it's somewhat suggestive along this dimension here of something like occupational social status dimension or something along those lines. Up here we've got the managers and the professionals, and down here we've got the unskilled manual workers. Quite what the so-called second dimension actually is here is difficult to tell. My guess is it's nothing more than non-linearity, basically. Basically, in order to fit these points better, some of the distances here are not easily represented in one dimension, so you have to sort of stretch them out a little bit. But basically, nothing terribly surprising here. So let's move on then to the later period. Now, remember that rather than looking at 5 by 5 by 3, we're now looking at 11 by 11 by 19, I think. 19 different time points. Different coding scheme. We're going to do exactly the same sort of thing, fit the same, roughly the same sorts of models here, beginning with our so-called UNIDIFF or log multiplicative layer effect model to look at overall whether or not association has increased or decreased. If we do so, this is the pattern that we get. What we're plotting here are the UNIDIFF parameters, one for each table. We've got Scotland basically in black. We've got England and Wales in white. And then we've got 95% confidence intervals around each of these points. These are actually so-called quasi-confidence intervals, so they allow us to simply eyeball the points here and see whether any arbitrary pair of points is different from any other pair of points, is different from each other, rather. Okay, So, what do we actually see here? It seems to me that two points really jump out from this plot here. First of all, the less interesting point, which is that in general, and of course, abstracting from the fact that all these confidence intervals here are all intersecting each other, it does look as though association in Scotland is a little bit bigger, but not so much that you would actually make a big deal out of it. It certainly would upset some of our Scottish cousins to believe that their society, if anything, was a little bit more closed than ours, at least in this period here and in this sense, since they like to tell us that they have a much more equal and open society. That's not what this data is suggesting. It's actually suggesting there's not much difference between England and Wales and Scotland. But if anything, things actually go slightly the other way. And then, of course, but that's really a minor thing, because the big thing is really how this point sticks out down here. So during most of this period, things go up and down a bit in a somewhat unsystematic sort of way, really between 72 all the way through here to the early 1990s. And then things seem to get a bit different down here. This is a naive interpretation of that would be that association has decreased. Things have become a little bit more open in terms of who chooses whom, as it were, at least in terms of occupational background. Okay. Again, a slight caveat, if you look carefully, you'll see that this confidence interval here actually overlaps this one here, which would suggest that there's not much difference or not any difference between the BHPS data point in 1991 and this data point from the EU SILT data in 2005, but of course BHPS always stands out a little bit. You'll see that it stands out in terms of this cluster here of having a somewhat lower level of association, and that's is actually a general feature of the BHPS data. If you look at classic intergenerational social mobility tables, BHP stands out from other data collected at similar points in time as suggesting that association between origins and destinations is weaker than in other similar tables. Quite why that is, I don't know. 5 minutes. Okay, good, because I'm nearly at the end. Right. Again, let's do the trick then of looking at the pattern. So we've said that for most of that time period, things just bobble around a little bit, but at the end it's different. So let's take some data from that early middle period and see how it looks in terms of one of our scaled association models. What we've actually done is, for that middle period, looked at four different pooled data sets. Basically, we've pooled Scotland for the very early period and pooled Scotland for the later period and pooled England and Wales for the earlier period and pooled them for the later period, simply to get the numbers bigger so that we try to eliminate a lot of the sampling fluctuation in where precisely these points are plotted. So if we would, this is just one of the four possible plots for that early period, but actually if we put anyone other here, you would not be able to see the difference. Basically, they look almost identical to this one here. So it doesn't really matter whether we look at England and Wales in 89 to 93 or whether we look at it for an earlier time period. Okay, so what do we see here? Well, again, nothing actually terribly surprising. As we go along a sort of line from here up to about here, there is some kind of classic occupational status dimension of some sort. Professionals here, employers and managers here, semi-skilled and unskilled manual here, together with the personal services. And that's quite important. Note where this personal services group is up here, because that will become important in a moment, as will, to a slightly lesser extent, the relative position of this point here, the self-employed own accounts. And then down here we've got the agricultural occupations. In any of these kinds of exercises, agricultural occupations always form the second dimension, basically. Presumably it's reflecting not just social distance but geographical distance to some extent here. You tend to marry people who are in your spatial environment, not just in your social spatial environment. So it's perhaps not so surprising that they are, these guys are intermarrying a little bit and not so much intermarrying with the people in more urban settings. All right, so now we should look then at how this turns out for our final point here. So this is the 2005 data. Now recall that what we found was that or what the UNIDIF model would allow us to test is whether or not the strength of association differed over time. But of course it actually turns out that not only does the strength of association differ over time here, but actually the pattern of association differs as well. So for example, where are they now? Our personal service workers, which were somewhere up here with the semi-skilled and so on, have actually moved closer to the white-collar categories. And our, where are those? Semi-skilled unmanual, no, not self-employed own accounts, these guys here, they were, in the previous slide, much more over in this direction down here, but they seem to have now formed a little cluster with the manual workers up here. So, things have changed a little bit. Apparently, 2005, we have somewhat weaker association, we'll have a different pattern of association. Or do we? Okay. The question that arises, of course, are these real changes, or are they data artifacts? And the answer, and as far as I can figure it out, is that we can't tell. And we can't tell in two different occasions. We can't tell, actually, whether the 72 data really differs from the 49 and the 59-60 data because of the way in which we had to code the data. And to cut a long story short, there is actually no straightforward way to recode the 72 data into exactly the same categories as the 49, 59, 60 data. What we did was a very, very elaborate exercise in matching occupational categories from the extant lists that existed, but our ability to actually map these is somewhat limited. There are some kinds of distinctions that people made in the 40s and 50s which were not made in later periods. So we have some doubts about how successful we have been there. It also is unfortunately the case that the coding of the 2005 data raises some concerns. What I've shown you is based on coding the 2005 data to the best fit that you can make to the socioeconomic categories. Unfortunately, there is again no simple, as it were, mapping to do this. There is a lookup table supplied by David Rose from the University of Essex, which is not endorsed by ONS, which does the best that he can. Even he concedes that probably there's an error rate of about 10%. We have some doubts about whether or not things really changed in 2005 or whether the change is artifactual again because of problems in the coding. Now, for that latter period, we can actually do one thing about it, which is to try and compare BHPS in 1991 with the EU silk data in 2005 on the basis of the so-called NSSEX, both of which these data sets are in principle codable to. Not actually, as it turns out, in exactly the same way, but much closer than, for example, the way in which one's able to code the 2005 data to the socioeconomic groups. If it's any reassurance, what one actually finds there is a difference between the 1991 BHPS and 2005. In other words, you replicate this sort of decrease, both, in fact, in terms of the strength of association and in terms of the pattern of association. Even when you use the NSX, it turns out the pattern is slightly different. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, that's some reassuring evidence that we really have captured some real change. On the other hand, you might say, I'm still not actually completely convinced that the 2005 data are reliable. And in fact, I think actually that's where what we tend to believe, that the 2005 data are not coded with the same degree of rigor as the earlier data sets are. And well, there are a number of reasons which we can go into in question time as to why I think that's the case. So, what's the big storyline at the end? The big storyline is we don't know. The data aren't actually good enough to allow us to tell whether or not there has been real change or the change that we observe is simply an artifact. And that's more or less inevitable, in fact, when you are making comparisons, essentially at the end there, between two data points. You can't distinguish real change from artifactual differences.
That's it?
Yep, that's it. They don't have it, Steve. They don't have... because you need a household survey. So you need within each household to know both the husband's father's class and the wife's father's class. And in the BESs, you don't have that. I don't think in any... I don't know about the most recent ones. You would be more informed about that. But certainly in the past, none of them have that information. I think actually what we've got here is every UK survey, apart from surveys carried out in Northern Ireland, which has that information in. And as far as I'm aware, there are no other nationally representative surveys that have that information.
And then some questions on the interpretation of the RC2 models.
Yeah.
So you present them with Cartesian coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I know that's what Cobb and others today and others have done.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me there's quite an odd way to present them,
mm-hmm.
because they invite you to sort of look at the Euclidean distances,
mm-hmm.
When actually the structure of the model is one where distance on one dimension can cancel out distance on another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether you could comment on that.
No. I haven't got any better idea. Have you got a better idea how to do it?
No.
That's the problem. I mean, we thought about this. Again, it's one of these things where we had to show something. And we thought about it for a long time and thought, this is as good as anything else, but if someone's got some other way of doing it, I would love to know.
Well, let me push you a bit further, because you actually, at least on one of the graphs, maybe this one, talked about a dimension that was a diagonal there. So you were, I mean, your previous answer just that you were aware of this problem, but yet you went on to interpret the results as if you could talk sensibly about the Euclidean distances.
But hang on a minute, the axes here are completely arbitrary. So. Yeah, but we can rotate this around, and then we can look at distances in this direction. These are well defined. I mean, distances to the axes are defined by the model.
So, one thing that's not arbitrary is the center point.
True, yeah, that's true.
And
Uh,
Okay. Another question? Yeah? Other questions?
Just a quick question. Did you at least consider the possibility of using service from other countries that maybe would have better data? I can't really make any useful suggestions. The only thing I was thinking about is maybe the panel study of income dynamics in the US, which is a household panel. I'm pretty sure they have some kind of social origins, but it's really quite
not. I can answer that very straightforward. No, we didn't consider using data from other. We working with 19 odd surveys, all of which are coded in very different ways, is a considerable investment of time without very much reward initially. And so the idea of extending it to other countries beyond the UK didn't immediately grab us as something that we wanted to do. My guess is, I mean, and this is entirely uninformed, but simply is based on the lack of other people doing this. I kind of have this view that if it exists, someone would have done it, as it were. That there are not very many countries that have a very long sort of run of data sets. And since our focus was really to try and look at change over time, then, you know, to add a cross-national comparison, it's not obvious what that would illuminate exactly. But could be interesting. Something for you to do.
I take it you don't have any information on fathers' incomes.
Zero information in any of the data sets. There, as far as I know, there are only two data sets that have that kind of information. Or actually, there's three, but no one uses the other one. I mean, BHPS has it, and not BHPS. NCDS has it, and BCS has it. And I suppose the Millennium cohort will have it as well, but it's not very useful at the moment in this context. But no, we just don't have it. So there's nothing very much that we can do about that, unfortunately.
Who's next?
Actually, I can have a follow-up on that. What happens if you encode it, the best you can get for an occupation, and you put in the average occupational earnings in that period from the census, or?
Well, you won't have it from the census because there's no census data.
There should be some.
I think it's almost impossible to get that kind of information. Because of course, if for the earlier ones, we're going back to people who were brought up in the early years of the 20th century, and I'm not sure that you're really going to get any very reliable occupational earning data from then. And even now, it's very difficult. One could get, of course, current earnings for the occupational categories, and then say, okay, let's project those back 30 years or something like that. But what you win on the swings, you lose on the roundabouts. I mean, this is a big problem here, that we've already got enough compromises and fudges to try and make things quasi-equivalent to each other to introduce another. Well, meaning we'll never get this published. It seems difficult enough at the moment. Go on. Have another supplementary.
why not differentiate it by sort of when they're in their 20s rather than the time of the survey? I mean, of course, not everybody marries in their 20s, but...
Well, we don't have any occupation... Okay, when they're in their 20s.
So do it by cohort rather than by...
Yeah, okay, yeah. Actually, well, okay, two answers to this. Again, one which contradicts the other. We started off with the idea of not doing that, simply because it's difficult to know what this means, because as time moves on, of course, a larger and larger proportion of marriages terminate after 5, 10 years or whatever, and we have no observations on those marriages whatsoever. So our argument to start off with was, we simply define a population, the stock of current marriages right now, and at least that's consistent across the years. Of course, underlying it, there are different processes that are going on involving different proportions of people to produce that stock of current marriages. But we just sort of say, let's just ignore that. Once you start cutting things up into cohorts, of course, you get differential censoring for different ages, as it were, and different durations of marriage. And there's not very much you can do about that. Some people in the literature, for example, on educational homology, have tried to overcome that by saying, okay, let's just look at the marriages that have happened in the last 3 years. Say, okay, and let's assume that very few people, it's negligible the proportion of people that get married and then they're not married 3 years later. But the problem is, with this day, once you start doing that, we hardly have any observations in each of the cohorts, and then we would have to compromise by reducing the number of occupational categories. So again, it swings and roundabouts. What you would gain in one direction, you would lose in another direction, and you wouldn't really know how you would compare these things. So that was the first part. The other part of the answer is that at one point we then contradicted ourselves, looking at the earlier time period, of course. We wanted to try and look a little bit closer. Is it plausible that the change in the earlier time period, the apparent weakening of association, really is a coding artifact? And we know the coding's lousy for 72. So one thought I had was, well, why don't we do roughly what you've just suggested? Actually, what we did was, for each of the first three surveys, we divided them four ways. We had a cross-classification of basically person's age by whether they were got married early or married late, relatively speaking. Okay, so we looked at, I've forgotten exactly how we married, how we defined early marriage and late, but relatively young people getting married in the relatively recent past and relatively old people getting married in the relatively recent past and versus in the distant past. Okay. And then we fitted these UNIDIF models and looked to see whether or not over those four subsets in each of these data sets there was any discernible pattern of change. And the answer was that in the first two surveys the pattern was the same. Basically there was no difference among these groups basically in the pattern of association. In the 72 one, actually it did look as though those who had got married more recently displayed weaker association. Again, once you start thinking about it, there are lots of different ways in which you can interpret that, and you certainly can't rule out that it's an artifact of measurement error. Because actually the difficulty is that you cannot assume the measurement error is random. If you had random measurement error, then we would believe that that would tend to have a uniform effect on the pattern of association for all of these four groups. But the one thing that we do know is that the measurement error is not random. Why is it not random? Because whole groups of occupations are coded simultaneously in the same way. So there must be correlated error involving those groups. And that's the only way we can do that, because we don't have the original information about what each individual said their occupation. They've already been pre-coded into some groups. So I kind of gave that up as being a hopelessly circular kind of thing, that which actually will just create more confusion rather than anything else.
Can I add another suggestion?
Sure. We're very much in the market for suggestions.
I'm not sure if it's possible, but if you were willing to look at first marriages only, then and you look at marriage cohorts, so successful first marriages, then the new Understanding Society with 40,000 households, maybe would allow you to look back some 35.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as soon as they have data on the parental generation, which I think they don't have in the first wave, but they will collect in second, third waves, that would actually add another much-needed data point. I mean, I think our big difficulty is how to interpret the 2005. We've got one data point which comes right with a big gap before the others, and there are lots of reasons to distrust that data, actually. The fact of the matter is that data was collected, if people don't know, as part of basically an EU-mandated initiative which forced national statistical offices to collect this data in all EU countries. As part of the EU treaty obligation. The British Office of National Statistics did not take this very seriously, I must say. And they put absolutely minimal effort into collecting the data. And this is obvious. There's vast amounts of missing data. The actual instrument that was designed in the first place is ridiculous. I mean, it just looked as though it's been knocked together in you know, 2 weeks or something like that. I mean, compared to what the steps that other national statistical agencies took. And who knows what they did with the data once they got it. Certainly they collected very, very minimal occupational information because they really did not want to do this and they wanted to devote the minimum of resources to it. So there are good reasons to distrust this data.
It's supposed to harmonise data. It sounds very unreliable.
I think we're
Thank you very much. I have no idea how to announce it for next Monday, actually. I forgot to look on the website. And there's someone Wednesday in Nuffield as well.
Two fantastic seminars coming up.
Thanks for that.